Hello everybody, and here's the last of this series on Kabbalah, You and the Cosmic Christ, number 6. And we'll be looking at the Jesus Prayer and the Beatitudes and doing some summing up tonight. So hopefully you're wide awake and ready to go, and we will begin. When we look at the Beatitudes, I have to say that I have to acknowledge a friend and teacher, Dr. Michael Hatwick from Washington, D.C., and if it's any use to you to know this, he's a prominent Mason in Washington, and he was President Obama's primary advisor on healthcare. He is a Republican, but he worked with Obama because he thought that healthcare was utterly essential, and in fact, he came over to the U.K. and spent a lot of time asking us about the NHS. We really didn't know a lot about the NHS. We managed to pass him on to some other people. So it just goes to show that people who are studying mysticism are in the right places. We may not be able to see them, but they're there. And those who are wise are seeking people like us in the background to look after them. I know that Zev Ben Shimon Halevi, Warren Kenton, my former teacher, is one of the advisors to Prince Charles in the United Kingdom. And it's good to know that there are people like that, just quietly in the background, just saying the odd, gentle comment. So Michael first spoke about the Beatitudes in a workshop I went to back in 1996, so gosh, that's a while back, and his book, The Abba Tradition, focuses on them. He writes in a very intellectual way. He doesn't do emotional Kabbalah, but he's still worth checking out if you're interested. So slide number 3. The Beatitudes, well, they're the things that everybody knows are Christian and pretty much everybody utterly ignores because they're all about humility and we really aren't that good at humility. And just like the Lord's Prayer or the Jesus Prayer, as I prefer to call it, they are both in the Gospel of Matthew and in the Gospel of Luke, but they're in different formulae in Matthew and in Luke. The Lord's Prayer in Luke is much shorter, and the Beatitudes are quite different in Luke. They're not called the Beatitudes there. It's worth checking them out to see how different they are, but it would be advanced Kabbalah to work through both Gospels with you, and maybe we'll do that one day, but I think we'll stick with Matthew for the moment because it's the easiest to fit on the tree with the knowledge that we've got. So Beatitude, I like that. It's only an English version, but they are the Beatitudes. They're how we are meant to be if we want to call ourselves Christian. I'm not actually fond of calling myself a Christian, even though I'm a minister in a branch of the Christian faith, because the second you say, I'm a so-and-so, the implication is, and you're not. And the original teaching, I think, is inclusive. So it's quite difficult when you say, I'm a Christian, because it's, and you're not. Therefore, we're making an egoic comparison immediately. So it's a tricky one. However, the Beatitudes are the foundation of the followers of Jesus' work. And they are translated as blessed. Blessed are those. But the word is Makarios. In Latin, it's Beatitudo, which means happy or fortunate or blissful. But we're always translating them as blessed are. But in the Greek, it's actually happy. I don't know if you remember the name Archbishop Makarios, who was a Greek Orthodox priest many years ago. But his name was always Archbishop Happy. And that's what they mean. So they're trying to show us that we are happier if we adopt these attitudes. You probably know the Beatitudes quite well, but I will recite them right now. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now there is a sort of ninth beatitude, which is a reiteration of the first and last, where Jesus actually says, you, rather than blessed are they. And he says, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. That's because of the Christ consciousness. That's because of what we are teaching, what we are learning. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Not terribly cheerful, and I'm not on the line for saying let's all go out there and get persecuted. But it's not so much persecuted, it's actually you're going to be misunderstood. If you live by this creed, you're going to be misunderstood, because it just isn't the creed of the ego, it's the creed of the soul. Now, the next slide shows how the Beatitudes are placed on the Tree of Life. They actually fit on the Tree of Life, the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, but I've put them on the ladder on this slide. So you can see that they are all in the world of Yetzirah, which is the psychological world. That's the second world up from the bottom, the third world down from the top. It's the world of forms, of formation, of her fleshing things out. And it's the world in which we human beings live in our psyches the whole time. We are physical beings, but we live up here in our minds. And if you follow Jesus' teaching with ask, believing, and it is given, and other teachers, and your basic Louise Hay, people like Neville Goddard, and people like that, they're always saying what you put out, you get back. Simple law of karma, and the Beatitudes are actually karmic. They say what you will receive karmically, for good and for bad, if you follow these. So you can probably just about work out the colour code. But the first one, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's actually the sort of brown Sapphira in the centre. Just about see, it looks a bit red in the key, but it's the brown one. It's actually the Tiferet of Yetzirah, which is the place of the solar plexus chakra, the place of balance, place of being centred. And it is at the base of the world known as Berea, which is the world of heaven or spirit. So it's basically saying, if you are poor in spirit, yours is the kingdom of heaven. Well, Tiferet in the world of Yetzirah is at the kingdom of heaven, the base of the world of spirit. And what it means is the humble in spirit. It doesn't actually mean poor as in broke or poverty stricken. It means those with humility in spirit. And that means that we are centered. If we have a humility in spirit, we are open to spirit. Therefore, we are not going to impose our beliefs on spirit. We're going to allow it to come. We're going to allow the new to come. Because whenever something comes from spirit, it's fresh. It's new. It's not a repeat. It may be a similar teaching to one before, but it will always feel really fresh and really different. The second one, blessed are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted. That's one down immediately. That is the yesod of Yetzirah, the foundation, the ego of Yetzirah, which is also the da'at of Asiya, the physical world at the bottom. So the ones who mourn are the ones who are in their ego. We mourn when we're in our ego. We feel sorrow from our soul, but we don't actually grieve. To grieve is the state of missing what went before, to be focusing on the past. The ego brings the past into the present and the future into the present. And you can't mourn without bringing the past into the present, because whatever we're mourning is over. It doesn't mean to say we shouldn't grieve, absolutely not, but it's saying that to grieve is part of the status of the ego. And that's always worth knowing, because we'll grieve, but if we want to grieve healthily, we need to stay focused in the present and not to add too much weight to our grief. Which brings us back to Deepak Chopra's saying, I'm not asking you to give up your pain, I am asking you to give up your suffering. And they shall be comforted. Well, you can be comforted in two ways at the level of the ego. You can be comforted by drawing yourself up to yourself, to the level of the kingdom of heaven, or you can be comforted by another person also at the level of the ego. Usually when somebody is comforting you at the level of the ego, they'll tell you their story of mourning. And that's what we do so often. We go up to somebody who's upset or grieving and tell them, we understand because this happened to us. And we splurt our story out on them. Whether it helps or not, I don't know. I personally don't find it helps, and I try very hard not to do it. So you will be comforted by somebody at your peer level, which may not be comfort at all, or you'll be comforted by being drawn up to being centered in yourself. The third one is, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And this is a moot one. It's interesting because that's maybe all that the meek inherit. Once the capitalists and the arrogant have finished with the earth, that may be all the meek are left with. So that's a way of looking at it, which is not necessarily a positive one. But it's, if we're looking at this from the karmic point of view, those with humility, the meek are those with humility, they will survive because they will not be part of the karma of the earth. They won't be part of the karma of the family. They won't be part of the karma of their country. Those who work with humility will always be open to the upper worlds. They will always be open to the voice in their head. They will always be open to the voice of the wise person. So therefore, they will be able to move out of the area of danger, if there should be an area. But also, we inherit the earth, if we're meek, from a good point of view, in that we can see it afresh every day. If we actually look with humility every morning, we will see things fresh. Bernie Siegel, the great cancer surgeon from Connecticut, who wrote Love, Medicine and Miracles, said that all of humanity's problems would be solved if we lost our memory at midnight every night. Because we'd see the new world anew. We would not go into all the stuff about where the problems are. And we would actually treat people with a great deal more respect. The humility is where you treat somebody as they could be, as the perfect person, where you assume that they are who they could be. And guess what? If you treat people like that, an awful lot of the time they respond like that. It's when you start projecting onto them all your feelings about how they are and what you think of them, that they sort of become this caricature. And it's really hard for people who aren't conscious to change if we're projecting things onto them. And the meek don't project. And the truly meek don't project. The false meekness of the ego, which is that, oh, don't ask me, there's nothing I can do. Oh, I'm so wounded, I can't possibly help. That's a fake meekness, and that will invoke karma. So the Beatitudes are trying to tell us that it's the attitude of why we're doing it and how we're doing it that counts. So if we are working with humility, which is the understanding that we may not be right, we're just working on being happy. The humble person will say, I'd rather be happy than right. So that's the positive beatitude. The negative beatitude is the one who just won't do anything, won't stand up, won't move, won't act at all. And this is a good point to bring in the question I got this week, which is again back on the subject of forgiveness, which we were talking about last week and the week before. And the question is, does the teaching on forgiveness apply to groups rather than individuals, such as Jews in the Holocaust, indigenous peoples in the Americas, for example? What's the dynamic that should guide those who profit from others' suffering, intentionally or not? I don't want to be wracked by guilt, but I do feel moved to be somehow responsive as I learn how my background privileges me based on what I consider misdeeds of my ancestors, even if they didn't know any better. Well, yeah, forgiveness is forgiveness. And G.K. Chesterton put it very succinctly about Christianity. Whatever his faults may have been, it's perfectly put. It says Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and not tried at all. And Christianity, as taught by Jesus, is you let go. You let go. You let go of everything, including the group karma. Because if you don't let go, you're part of the karma. That doesn't mean you condone it. That doesn't mean to say you don't join the society that's going to support repatriation of people who have been exiled, that isn't going to look after horses and dogs. We are stewards of this planet. We have absolutely a duty to do everything we can to see justice. But justice is always tempered with mercy. So we have to be just and merciful and act with humility. And that's not easy. So should the Jews forgive the Holocaust? Yes. That doesn't mean say condone it. That doesn't mean to say let them get away with it. Absolutely not. But if you don't give it up, give up the habit of talking about it, repeating it, going on about it, you will recreate it. We talk about learning from history, but the thing is we don't learn from history. We repeat history. We go on around it again and again and again. It's good to know it happened, but definitely not to focus on it. Should we have Holocaust memorial days and things like that? Only if they're to work on positive. We do tend to get absolutely bogged down nowadays in the badness of stuff. And we do our best in our own egoic ways. All these races for life, for cancer research, for example. I'm not saying they're bad. They're not bad. They're good. But they're not solving the problem. They're raising money to put into the research into physical alleviation of a disease that is a disease of the soul. Cancer is definitely a disease of the soul. Most diseases have some aspect of the soul. So when we throw money at the medicine that's just going to remove physical signs of the disease without going to the cause of the disease, we haven't got a solution. We haven't got a result there. And if we don't forgive, we will return to the illness. Forgiveness is always just work to give it up, and it's not easy. Nobody ever said it was easy. But the second you go into, I can't heal because of the Holocaust, I can't heal because of this wound, I can't heal because I'm descended from slaves, I can't heal because of the white privilege, you're diving into the wound. And I'm sorry, I am white and I'm privileged, and it may sound like I'm being like that, but the second you use your lack of privilege as the wound and won't forgive, you're re-harming yourself. The second we use our privilege to condemn, we're re-harming ourselves. The second we don't let go, the second we don't live in the now and look at things with fresh eyes, we are part of the karma, we're part of the problem. And no, Christianity isn't easy. It's incredibly difficult. And no, I haven't quite forgiven everybody in my life. I certainly have still got layers of the onion, certainly to do with my mother and several other aspects in my life. But it's about continuing work, 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 to let go, let go. Just remember, Jesus kissed Judas. That was not the act of a hypocrite. That was the act of somebody who said, it's all part of it. The betrayal is part of it. Betrayal is part of the journey. And the betrayal cannot happen unless I allow it. If you think about every betrayal in your life, look at where you colluded, because you stayed in the situation. I think there's a good saying which says, if somebody hurt me once, it's their fault. If the same person hurt me twice, it's my fault. Now, I wouldn't actually use the word fault there, but certainly if you stay in a situation where you've been hurt previously, you are colluding with the situation and you get into the whole difficult area of codependence. And if we look at, I mean, the Americas, it's a really difficult one with the indigenous people because they were just slaughtered and wiped out. With the Jewish folk, they could have left. They could have left Germany. Now, I know that's a terrible thing to suggest, that they just picked up and moved away, but it was quite obvious what was happening with Hitler. Some people might say that's the beginning of what's happening in the USA. We have to watch that one with great concern. But the way the world is now, with all the eyes open in the world, hopefully it can't happen again. But the German thing, if the Jews just said, no, we're not having this, and picked up and walked to the borders, the rest of the world would have been alerted far sooner. And also the German infrastructure would have gone down quite badly because the Jewish folk were in positions of power. I'm not saying that would have been an ideal solution. There are no ideal solutions. But there are people in all difficult situations who just say, I'm leaving this. And they pick up their beds and they walk. They leave their positions and they walk. It's a difficult teaching. I'm not saying it's not a difficult teaching. But if there is a situation where you and your family are threatened, you leave. You leave behind your possessions, you leave behind the situation, and you go and risk the new. Terrifying, I know, but that's what Jesus did all the time. He got up and walked. Christianity is not easy. Okay, next beatitude. Blessed are they who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. That moves down from the Malkut of Yetzirah up to Gevurah, which is judgment and discernment. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Now that sounds like you go out and stop forgiving immediately. No, it's saying once you have been meek and had the humility, then you go after the righteousness. Then you stand up and march for peace. You never march against war, you march for peace. You stand up for what is right from a position of humility. You just say, this isn't right, so I'm going for that. You don't focus on the badness. You don't focus on the war, because whatever you focus on becomes bigger. To be humble, to become meek, is to just not put any more energy into the negative. As soon as you put more energy into the negative, it becomes bigger. So you have to be very discriminating. We all have to be extremely discriminating. Where do we put our energy? Where is the campaign? Again, the cancer research stuff is putting money into the medicine that can take the cancer back to zero. It will take the tumours down sometimes, not always. In fact, there's many people saying that up to 90% of chemotherapy doesn't work. I had my life saved by chemotherapy once, but I had to work on the rest of it to get my life back, because all the chemotherapy could do once was take the tumours away, but it couldn't stop them growing. So blessed are they who hunger and thirst after righteousness is about you let go and then you fight the good fight, not the bad fight. You never join the march against war. You never put up a placard saying, stop the war. You say, peace, peace, love. Because whatever the eye hears and whatever the ear hears becomes a neural pathway much more easily than you can even imagine. So if you just see war, the universe for some reason doesn't seem to do negatives. If you just go, not war, you're still talking war. Next beatitude, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Pure karma. That one is so simple. Blessed are the merciful, and that's placed at Hesed, the place of mercy, for they shall receive mercy. So as you give mercy, you will receive mercy. But you have been to discernment first. That's important. You follow these beatitudes from Tiferet down, then up to Gevurah and across to Hesed. So you know in which order to apply them. You've been discerning and now you can be merciful. You don't act with mercy before you consider. Okay, next beatitude, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. This is placed at Da'at, which is the window between the worlds, which is the place of knowledge in Yetzirah and the ego, the foundation of spirit. So blessed are the pure in heart, are those whose soul, whose heart are open, who are willing to receive the new from spirit, because they shall see God. The pure in heart are actually at the cat flap point where they have the access to the higher world, and they shall see, hear and experience the divine in them. Because at that level, it's still the divine in you. It's God the immanent speaking with God the transcendent. But it's still the aspect of the divine in you. But you can see it and feel it and experience it. And to be pure in heart is all these other things I've said, is to drop the blame, drop the campaign against, focus on the good, and to present as somebody who's campaigning for good. Next one is, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And again, it follows quite naturally to be hunger and thirst after righteousness, to be merciful, therefore you seek peace. At all stages you seek peace. You do not go anti-war, you seek peace. And the humble will understand that that means happiness over being right. You don't hold to the argument just for the sake of pushing to be right. If you can't help, you move away. That's really important. If there's nothing you can do in a circumstance that's going to enhance or heal the situation, move away and create a space for somebody else to do it. Because if you stay there, keep pushing against the pricks, as the saying is, you just make them bigger. And finally, we come straight back down to Tiferet, where we started, which is, blessed are they who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, we started with, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And now we're coming to, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, when you're in Tiferet, when you're in your true self, your family won't understand you, the world won't understand you, people will just, they'll throw bricks at you. Not necessarily bad bricks, but this is where you're going to get trolled. This is where you're going to get the family going, you're talking rubbish. Because you are holding on to righteousness, to ferret, holding on to truth and beauty. And others won't like that and they won't see it. So you will feel that you're persecuted quite frequently. And that the temptation is to run away, which is perfectly understandable. I was counselling somebody this week who was saying, what do I do about my family? His family are Muslim and they're in Pakistan and they're nagging at him to marry a Muslim woman whom they've chosen for him. But he's a Kabbalist and that in the wider sense, as in he's working on the structure of mysticism. And he knows that he can't do what the family want him to do. He's not at the stage of being willfully fighting them. He's actually in his 40s now. He just knows that this isn't right for him. So he's gone through this process of working out that whether he can let go of the family, and he's now decided that he will let go of them as much as he possibly can. He's just not going to engage in the family stuff. That doesn't mean he's going to cut them off completely or be hostile to them. He's just not going to show up for the stuff, and he's just not going to play that game. And they will rise up and shout at him. As soon as you move away, the family will come after you and start shouting. But that's their problem. Remember that phrase, not my circus, not my monkeys. And it's always important, are these your monkeys? Is this your circus? Can you do anything right now in this situation that will change it for good? If not, walk away and allow somebody else to do what good they can. We could go on about the Beatitudes all night, but we've got loads of other things to do. So I'm going to move swiftly on, because we're halfway through already, to talk about the Jesus Prayer, the Lord's Prayer. Now, that fits on the centre column of Jacob's Ladder beautifully. So much Kabbalah is so matched to the New Testament. It's extraordinary. The patterns in the New Testament mean that somebody who put it together really had to know this stuff. They really had to be working with these patterns. Can I prove that? No, I can just present evidence to you that hopefully you will find convincing. But the Lord's Prayer will fit on the Tree of Life, but it fits much better on the extended tree, straight up the middle of Jacob's Ladder. And if you remember, in the book of Isaiah and also in the Gospels, the phrase, make straight the way of the Lord, is prevalent again and again. John the Baptist says it, and it's in the book of Isaiah it says it. The idea is that you take the Tree of Life and you extend it so that we are back in communion with God again, because the Hebrews had got very tied into the law rather than into spirit. And of course Christianity has done exactly the same. The idea of Christianity was to free us up again, to put us back in touch so we didn't need priests. And the Jesus Prayer does just that. It starts at the very top, the Keter of Keters at Absolute, with Our Father. Now, this is patriarchal, obviously, because Jesus was teaching in the patriarchal world. But so that's Mother, Father, God, right at the top. So the first thing we're doing when we say the Jesus Prayer is going to the Keter of Keters, to I Am, to the source of everything, by saying Father or Father, Mother. You would always miss out the non-sephira at this level, because that's the way through to perpetual union with the divine, and we're not there absolutely yet. So the second sephira would be, who art in heaven? And you can see by looking at the ladder that this sephira is at the top of the Breviatic world of spirit, the world of heaven. So If prayer is saying quite simply, God is also at this level. God is at the level of the I am. God is also at the level of the crown of heaven. God is in heaven. And just dropping the level of our comprehension so that we can begin to identify with the divine. Because beyond that sephira, the second sephira down, we really can't conceive of God at all. But once we've got the idea of God and heaven, we're starting to make images so we can start to work out what it means. The third sephira down is hallowed be thy name. This is Da'at, which is the window between worlds, which is a point of communication between worlds. So that makes perfect sense, as in hallowed be thy name, which is the hallowing, is the honouring of God's name, the spreading of the name. This is the place of El Hai Shaddai, the name of God, which is the multi-breasted one, the nurturing. So this is the aspect of the divine that nurtures the world of spirit to flow divinity down to the rest of us. Fourth sephira down is the kingdom of God, the lowest sephira in the world of Atzilut, the divine world, which is known as Malkut, the kingdom. So thy kingdom come, the kingdom of God come. So that's actually a command to draw down the kingdom of heaven into our psyches, because this is the crown of the world of the psyche. Apologies if this is a little bit difficult for you to take it in. Just sort of listen and allow, because this workshop is for beginners. It's not for people with huge experience of Kabbalah, so some of it may go right over your head. But if you come back to it another time, it will make more sense. So the kingdom of God come, thy will be done. That's another communication point. That is the da'at of the Yetzeratic world, the ego, the yesod of the spirit world. So it's calling thy will down, thy will be done in me. Next one is on earth as it is in heaven. This sephira is at the base of the world of heaven and at the crown of the world of earth. On earth as it is in heaven. And the place where on earth as it is in heaven is us, our solar plexus chakra. So we are the ones that bring heaven to earth. That's our job. When we are centered into Ferret in the place of truth and beauty, we bring heaven to earth. That's the job of the Christian, to bring heaven to earth. Next one, give us this day our daily bread. This is another cat flap window between the worlds, between the psyche and the physical. So it's basically saying what we believe will manifest physically in the world. So give us this day our daily bread is both an injunction for us to be fed psychologically and physically, but it's also acknowledgement that we will be given what we are creating. Next one down, forgive us as we forgive others. That's the base of the psychological world, and that is the Malkut of the psyche, forgiveness. If we don't let go of the past, then we are subject to the karma of the nation and the family. We must let go of the past to rise above karma. As soon as you rise above karma to Tiferet, you are the power in your life. When you're down below here, holding on to a lack of forgiveness, you are absolutely trapped. And the two below that are following on from that, lead us not into temptation. People always find that a really difficult one, because why would God lead us into temptation? But at that level down there, we can't see God. We're actually talking about what we would perceive to be God down there. This is the yesod of the right down at the physical world. It's even below our psychological understanding. So it's basically saying that whatever would lead us into temptation, at this level would be our own lower selves. So it's an affirmation to ourselves not to be led into temptation, and a prayer upwards to say, please draw us back up. And right down at the bottom, and deliver us from evil. The bottom sephira of everything is technically the furthest away from the divine. It's the coarsest part of the world. So whether it's actually evil is moot. The word is poneros, which is heaviness. So evil is heavy, and it's also chaotic. Divinity is, and the patterns of the creation that work are very ordered. Evil is always a breakout of that order into chaos, and the universe will always form itself back into order eventually. But its deliverance is evil is right down at the bottom of the ladder because it's the furthest away from the divine. And of course, the addition onto the Lord's Prayer is, for thine is the kingdom, or this is the kingdom of everything, the kingdom of earth, and the power would be the right-hand column, the glory would be the left-hand column, forever and ever would be going back up the central column, and Amen takes us back up to the Keter of Keter at the tops. For the Kabbalists, as soon as you say Amen, which basically means, and it is so, it's taking the prayer up to God and giving it to God. Right, next slide number 9. Jesus is called in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And we're sort of going around to, in a way, summing up this workshop here, because what I'm trying to do is show what may have been the intentions of the first Christians and the gospel writers in putting together the New Testament the way they did. And we have touched on this before, this idea of the first temple being a different version of the temple from the one that Jesus would have known. The second temple was brought into being 500 years before Jesus was born. Previously to that, it was the first temple. And the first temple was based on the Abrahamic teachings, not Moses' teachings. There's nothing wrong with the Moses story, the Exodus story, but the Moses teachings after that are the law books, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Before that, the first temple was based mostly on spirit, and the second temple was based mostly on law. And the order of Melchizedek was known as King of Salem. Jerusalem comes from the word Salem. Salem is the name of the kingdom that Melchizedek was said to rule, and he was the one who brought gifts of bread and wine to Abram as he was then, Abram and Sarah, before it was Abraham and Sarah. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was a priest of the Most High God. And he blessed Abraham, and also the oral tradition says blessed Abram and Sarah, and said, blessed be Abram of Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. So this is the priestly blessing. Melchizedek, who had no parents, you'll always find that messianic figures, priests, have odd genealogy, probably no parents or unusual parents. Melchizedek is also mentioned in Psalm 110. The Lord hath sworn and will not repent, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. This is a psalm of David, sent to be written by David, who is one of the messianic figures of the Hebrew Testament. He saved the Hebrews from the Philistines. And Melchizedek is mentioned 9 times in the book of Hebrews. 9 is relevant because there are 10 sephirot on the tree of life. So whenever there's a 9 mentioned in the New Testament, the 10th aspect is the divinity itself. So 9 mentions is still relevant. That they're basically saying that Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. So they're trying to take Jesus back to this teaching of God giving the priesthood to Abram. So what Christianity appears to be doing is taking this back pre-temple, taking it back so that we have direct communion with God. Now, Abraham became Abraham after this blessing, and Sarai became Sarah. They changed their names, which is quite a feature in the Hebrew Testament. When people become priests, they change their names. And Abraham started the tithing system, which I teach in my prosperity work, which has nothing to do with giving the 10%, first 10% of your income to your church. Nothing to do with that at all. The Abrahamic teaching, which becomes the Mosaic teaching, is quite clear. Even though it's spread out in the books of the law, it's put God first, which is your link to the divine. Whatever inspires you must come first in your life. Second comes celebration, which is taking care of you and yours and enjoying your life, bringing the fruits of God down into your life and enjoying them. And the third tithe is charity. Third tithe is only given every 7th year. It is not the first gift. You do not give directly to charity. you give to God and to yourself and then to charity. Because only when you've got yourself sorted and you understand your relationship with God and you celebrate it and you're prosperous, can you help others. And that brings us neatly back to your Run for Life or giving money to cancer research. Not saying you shouldn't do that, but that is giving to charity as a priority. Whereas what we need to do is get ourselves straight and balanced so we can teach so that the charity isn't needed. That's the idea. If we take care of ourselves first and our spiritual heritage and our spiritual teaching, and we teach others how to do that, we won't need the charities. And here on slide number 10, it's got the quotation from Hebrews, which says, without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning or days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually. Jesus only ever called himself the Son of Man. He never called himself the Son of God. We are all the Son of God. So in Temple Theology, which is the brainchild of Dr. Margaret Barker, former professor at Cambridge in theology, and by many others now teaching this and studying this, so Jesus would be the return of God's high priest. And the first temple, if you remember, was destroyed by King Josiah 500 years before the birth of Jesus. They found the books of Deuteronomy, Leviticus and Numbers somewhere in the temple. The high priest found them and brought them to the king, allegedly. We don't know what's true and what's not, but they realised that the temple had become corrupt. And it probably had, let's face it. Temples and churches do. Just look at all the ones we've got nowadays. So the temple was razed to the ground, and 30 years after that, the Babylonians invaded and then became the Babylonian exile. And again, the blame was put on, the blame for the fact that the Hebrews had been conquered was either because they didn't raise the temple to the ground soon enough or because they did raise the temple to the ground, depending on your point of view. However, after the Babylonian exile, King Ezra, who was the first king for the restored kingdom, rebuilt the temple with Persian money and built it into the second temple. And that temple became focused on law. Deuteronomy, Leviticus and Numbers became the primary teaching in the Hebrew Testament rather than the spirit. And the temple theology believes that Christianity was an attempt to bring us back to the first temple, that direct link to the divine, so that we are the temple. We, our physical bodies are the temple. And if you remember, the first and different temples differed in, well, there were four major ways they differed. The first temple had the goddess. They had the balance of masculine and feminine. So they had equality of worship. The second temple did not have equality of worship. It was patriarchal. First temple had focus on divinity. Each person could worship God. They could each bring their offerings. Yes, there was a high priest, and the high priest would take the offerings into the Holy of Holies, a high priest, possibly also the high priestess, and would bring them back out and give them to the people. But in the second temple, their high priest only became the only person who would ever go into the Holy of Holies one day of the year. And then in the second temple, they started using animal sacrifice, which previously had been a pagan thing. The first temple had no animal sacrifice at all. The sacrifices were vegetable, bread and wine. So the focus became the law. And also in the second temple, the king became the high priest, or was the high priest in the first temple. So the king had the job to be the spiritual leader. Queen Elizabeth in the United Kingdom is known as Defender of the Faith, which is the equivalent idea of being the high priest, though of course she doesn't do any priesthood apart from her Christmas speech, which is usually brings us very, very gently into some faith, which is quite beautifully done generally. But the high priest was in a political appointment in the second temple. So again, it comes down to the law again and again. So I'm sure that her first temple did become corrupt and the king was probably corrupt as well. But the idea behind it was what was trying to be restored. Now, this next slide shows the most beautiful painting. I don't know the author of it. It's a painting that hangs in my teacher, Zevman Shimon Halevi's office and he let me have a copy of it, which is lovely. It was painted for him. So that shows the four worlds again, which were the four courts of the first temple and the four courts of the second temple, but they work better in the first temple, I think. Absolute, the world of emanation, divinity. Now, there were four presences spoken of and written of in the first temple. They were known as the Eternal Father, who was the presence of Absolute, the Prince of Peace, the presence of Berea, the Mighty One of God, who was the presence of the third courtyard, Yetzira, and Wonderful Counselor, who was the presence of Asiya. They were angelic presences. They're also mentioned in the books of Enoch and some of the other non-canonical liturgy. The Eternal Father was later translated as Michael. Prince of Peace was translated as Raphael. Mighty One of God was translated as Gabriel. And the Wonderful Counselor, Uriel. Michael, or Michael as he's generally known, is the Archangel of Fire, of Emanation. Raphael, the Archangel of Air, of Berea. Gabriel, the Archangel of Water, of Yetzira. And the Wonderful Counselor, Uriel, is the Archangel of the Element of Earth. So the four greatest teaching archangelic presences. There are Seraphim and Cherubim. I think those are the only two ones, but I've forgotten my ranks of angels for the moment, but I think it's Seraphim and Cherubim. And they are beyond human concept, these great archangelic presences. And there is a whole theurgy or liturgy of the angels and the archangels, the Cherubim, and all the other ranks of angels in Kabbalah as well, which is a fascinating teaching. But sufficient to know that we know of these because of Handel's Messiah and the teaching in the book of Isaiah. The Wonderful Counselor, Mighty One of God, the Prince of Peace, the Eternal Father, are sung in Handel's Messiah. And they are First Temple references going straight back to these great eminences in the First Temple. So how does this concept of Christianity being a First Temple teaching work? Well, ideally, if we follow the teachings of Jesus, it restores us to direct communion with God. We have a prayer that puts us directly speaking to God. The Jesus Prayer is our link to the divine. All the other prayers are too. It also restores us to the idea of spirit or love before law. And it restores the goddess. The whole Virgin Mary teaching, this was lost in Protestantism because of the Reformation. Catholicism still has it. The Mary prayer, the Hail Mary in my church, which is liberal Catholicism, goes like this. Hail Mary, full of grace. The Christ is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, the human Christ. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us now and at the time of our victory over sin, disease, and death. It's only slightly different. The basic Catholic liturgy is pray for us at the hour of our death. But the more traditional liturgy is pray for us now and at the hour of our victory over sin, disease, and death. So it's taking the prayer back up to the Elohim, to Eloah. And we know that there was great lamentation about the loss of the divine, the feminine, in the Hebrew temple. It's all the way through the book of Jeremiah. I've got a little bit of it on slide number 14, which is, since we left off to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven and to pour out drink offerings to her, we have wanted all things and have been consumed by the sword and by famine. And the image on that slide shows Mary as Queen of Heaven. Now, the Queen of Heaven is greater than Mary. The Queen of Heaven is the Creatrix, the Elohim. But the stars, the crown of stars, is the symbol of the Queen of Heaven, the symbol of Eloah. And Mary in the Catholic liturgy is now made to be without sin. The idea of the Immaculate Conception, which is a
I think it only came in the 18th century or something like that, as an actual teaching of the church, this idea that Mary is a divine being and not really human at all, is another way of trying to come back to the goddess. And the human psyche will always try to balance. It will always try to bring back to the balance of masculine and feminine in the divine. I have to give you the official line from Christianity on the Queen of Heaven. This is in slide number 15. I'm not going to read it all out to you, but the fair dues to say that Orthodox Christianity just says, no, that's rubbish. Mary isn't the Queen of Heaven. The Queen of Heaven was just this heathen goddess, Ashereth or Astarte. She was the wife of the false god Baal. The motivation of women to worship Astarte stemmed from her reputation as a fertility goddess, and as the bearing of children was greatly desired among women of that era. That's not true. It's greatly desired by everybody of that era. The commandment in Genesis is go forth and multiply. It's not just the women of that era, though they were the ones concerned about whether they were going to die during childbirth, which is why they turned to the goddess, certainly. But the worship of this Queen of Heaven was rampant among pagan civilizations. Look at the terminology here. Sadly, it became popular among the Israelites as well. Well, yes, the statues of goddesses and the little god Bes were found in many, many archaeological digs in houses, in the Hebrew houses. And that's Second Temple stuff, because once you've lost the goddess in the temple, you're still going to go for gods of fertility. You're going to go for some kind of health, some kind of help in the bearing of children, in the perinatal deaths. In the women were the ones who were there at birth and death. They laid out the dead. They were the ones with the herbs. They really, really had to find something that was not just an all-masculine god. So the return of the feminine was really important. And also women were extremely fond of early Christianity because it gave them equal status. Christianity was for the outcast, it was for the slaves, it was for the poor folk, and it was for the women, because the patriarchal system wasn't. Right, slide number 16 is about temple theology and Dr. Margaret Barker, who is one of my great teachers. I've studied with her in person many times. She is a dear, sweet woman. She's far more Christian than I am. She is an Orthodox Christian. She attends Methodist Church, and she teaches in the Methodist Church in Borough Wash in Derbyshire. And she and I have had many a talk over a good meal, and it was so wonderful meeting her because I showed her the ladder. She'd never seen Jacob's ladder. And she just went, oh, it's the veil of the temple. It's the veil of the temple. And we were sitting there just going, and that bit goes there, and that bit goes there, and that bit goes there. She doesn't need it because she's a scholar, but she was absolutely validating it for me, which was incredibly moving for me. And she wrote me the most wonderful dedication for the book, A Woman's Worth, because she read through it and just said, this is exactly how it should be read. This is exactly how it would have been read in those days. And that just warmed my heart. Of course, she and I could be totally wrong, but hey, it makes us happy, and we don't care if we're not right. It makes us happy, and it's making a lot of other people happy too. But to run through slide number 16, it will give you an idea on whether you want to read any of her books. The Hidden Tradition of the Kingdom of God was the first one I read, and it just makes your jaw drop to see all these comparisons. Basically, she's coming back to the idea of resurrection is when a human becomes an angel. And Kabbalah actually teaches that humans aren't angels, but humans get to the level where we are both at the level of the angels and greater than the angels, because we have the level of free will, which the angelic forces don't. And she also says that early Christianity is based so much on Greek teaching, modern Christianity, and it's quite clear that Pythagoras knew First Temple teaching. So if we go back to First Temple, we can take the patriarchy out of the Greek teaching and take it back to the First Temple, which is far more egalitarian. We also discover the First Temple roots of the Eucharist. I don't have time on this webinar to talk to you about Kabbalah and the Eucharist, but the Mass, the Tridentine Mass, was built on the tree. There's no doubt about that. The Mass has changed a bit since the Latin Mass. They've moved things around a bit, but it still fits beautifully. And hopefully on another webinar, another series, I'll take you through that. And the sacraments too. The seven sacraments fit beautifully. There isn't time to go into that, so we've been doing the history of it more. But we can do that another day. I'm going to do a Kabbalah and healing webinar in the new year, which we may address some of those as well. Also, temple theology, it helps you understand how angels work, the aspects of free will. It's a setting for the wisdom tradition. It also helps equate Christianity with Islam. And it just reverses the story of Eden, brings Christians back to the original temple without the need for the teachings of atonement theory. And Christian theology matured really, really quickly. I mean, Christianity became major very quickly because it was based on original roots that fitted the cosmic diagram. That's what we believe. It may not be true. Don't believe me. I'm going to say that again at the end of the workshop. Don't believe me. It's really important that you find what works for you, not just sitting on somebody else's teaching. But I think Kabbalah helps us take Christianity back to the faith it was intended to be. Because modern Christianity makes Jesus the idol, not the icon. Icon means window. Jesus is meant to be the window that shows you the way to God. And that's what the great I Am teachings say, because it shows you the way you approach God. It doesn't make Jesus God staring at you. It means Jesus is somebody holding your hand, drawing you into your Christ consciousness. Jesus was most God and both God and human. So are we. As soon as we realise that, we step up to the mark. And it's such a shock when you realise it that you do hit humility. Because you just go, who am I to do this? And the answer is, you're the only one listening. Where you are is holy ground. You are the only person where you are who can act with divinity. Now, I follow Toledano Kabbalah. There are other forms of Kabbalah, and find whichever one works for you, absolutely. Now, Toledano Kabbalah is the one I use because it's the one the Bible is based on. Sorry, it's the one based on the Bible, wrong way around. Because at the beginning of Genesis, it says quite clearly, and God saw that it was good, and then God saw that it was very good. However, at the time of the Spanish Inquisition, the Jewish folk, the persecution was horrendous. Many of them did escape it. They saw it coming and they left. Again, that's what the mystic would do. But the people locked in the tribe won't. They'll stay because that's where their tribe is, that's where possessions are, that's where their home is, that's where they worship, and they're afraid to step away to the new thing. Only Tiferet can handle the new. Yesod, the ego, cannot handle the new. It goes round in circles about the old. So it's the brave who will address the new, who walk. Now, once the Hebrews had been expelled from the Iberian Peninsula after the Spanish Inquisition, they needed a reason why bad things happen to good people. Because when you're locked into Yesod, you can't say, I got cancer because of my life choices. I got cancer because I didn't forgive my mother. I got cancer because I have it in my genes and I didn't work on that. Now, genetic cancer is a falsehood from blood genetics, I believe, but it is a reality from psychological, emotional genetics, because it follows cancer and heart disease and other genetically believed in diseases follow down adoptive families as well as blood families. So that's environment. It may have genetic, physical genetics in it too, but environment is what will trigger these things. And environment, if you follow the teachings of Dr. Bruce Lipton, and I cannot recommend his work highly enough, he will teach you that it is the lining of the cell, which is its brain, not the nucleus. The nucleus is about the reproduction of the cell. The environment of the cell is what teaches the cell, what the cell responds to. And your environment is your physical environment, certainly, and your food, but also your thoughts, your emotional environment.
So, first temple teaching would have said to the Jews, what happened to you because of how you behaved. That would not be acceptable. You also couldn't say that to the Jewish folk now, who are descendants of the Holocaust, that's a good word for it. You can't say that to anybody who's not at Tiferet, because you're starting to say that you got karma because you're an evil person. You don't get karma because you're evil. Well, you might get karma. You will get karma if you're evil. You get karma if you are not thinking with free will. You get karma when you aren't using free will. You get karma when you're going round and round and round the same thoughts as the rest of the people in your tribe. You get karma if you don't think freely. So it's about stepping up. So that is the difficulty with being a mystic, is that you see it how it is and you know that you're responsible. So to answer that question at the beginning, what do I do about the sufferings being caused by my ancestors? Well, you make reparation, absolutely, but you don't hand out blame for the ancestors, and you don't go around colluding in other people's wound about your ancestors, but you certainly do what you can. Because you may be those ancestors for a start, but you do whatever you can for peace, for love, for spirit. And quite often that just means shutting up and going away. Now, there was a charismatic rabbi called Isaac Luria in Israel, to which country a lot of the Jews had gone after the diaspora from Spain and Portugal. And Luria had this insight, and it was a very valuable insight. It was exactly what they needed at the time. He came up with the idea that when God created the universe, he made a mistake and the vessels of the Sephirot shattered. And because the light, they couldn't bear the light that was flowed into them. So the vessel shattered and caused something to appear which was known as klipot, which is parts of the shattered vessels which attack the universe, attack good people. Basically, it's demonic. The vessel shattered became demonic and attacked people. This is seen in the alphabet of Ben Sira, the story of Lilith, the idea of Lilith being the antithesis of Eve, the evil feminine attacking the good feminine. So all these are later teachings for people who are outside the first temple of the understanding that I and God create my life together. Second temple teachings, Orthodox Christianity teaches there is an external evil, a devil, that will attack you. And Luria was the creator of this in the Jewish faith. It was exactly what they needed at the time, because they had just been expelled. They needed to understand that sometimes bad things happen to good people. Unfortunately, that was the time of the printing press, so therefore that was the Kabbalah that spread. And Christian Kabbalah was picked up at that point. That was when Christians started to adopt aspects of Kabbalah for Christianity. And they took the Lurianic approach because it fitted with the idea of the devil. And at that point, the Kabbalists who were not Lurianic basically hid the ladder. And the Lurianic Kabbalists didn't use the ladder because it contradicts that teaching. Once you fully understand the ladder, it tells you you are God. You are connected directly with God. Everything you do in your life is your responsibility. Therefore, there can be no blame. And the betrayal, if there was one, was you. Because you did not do what Spirit was telling you to do. Tough lesson. However, Jacob's Ladder returned. It came back into the public domain in the 1970s. It was first published by Zev Ben Shimon Halevi, published in a book, that is. Somebody else published it beforehand. He was angsting with his own teacher. We don't know who his teacher was because he's kept him hidden, which is fine. It may have been the same teacher as taught Neville Goddard, actually, who was a guy who was both Jewish and Muslim and American. We don't know. However, the ladder was known to mystics, but it was not kept out in the public domain with the
drawings and teachings that the Lurianic tradition taught. Isaac Luria, by the way, never wrote anything down, and he instructed his followers never to write his teachings down, only ever to teach them in the present tense as appropriate for the people. But of course, they got written down and crystallized, just like the Bible did and everything else. So Jacob's Ladder came out again, was published by one of Halevi's students, which was great because that meant that he wasn't the one who published it the first time. So when people started throwing flack at him, he could say it was out already, because it was time for us. We were coming back. What with the hippie revolution, all that, we were starting to come back to the idea that we created our own reality, that we were responsible, and that love needed to return. So we have a choice. I will always follow Toledano Kabbalah, because the last teacher of Toledano Kabbalah who wasn't in the hidden tradition was Moses Cordovero, who taught Toledano tradition. Moses Cordovero has written some wonderful stuff, which is free on the internet. It's hard to understand, but it's pure and it's beautiful. He wrote the Garden of Pomegranates and Toma Devorah, the Book of Deborah, which is a title I used for one of my books as well. Toma Devorah and My Book of Deborah. My Book of Deborah is based on Toma Devorah. It's actually the story of Jesus' life told by his adopted sister in 10 chapters, rising up through the 10 Sephirot. You don't have to be a Kabbalist to read it. It's pure Kabbalah from beginning to end as fiction. So the choice really is, you have to see the world as perfect with all its oddities and us as responsible, or you see the world as flawed from the very beginning and us as fighting to try and make it better. It's up to you. I don't mind. Completely up to you. But we're on four basic journeys. Kabbalah teaches that we're on the journey of incarnation from the crown of Atzilut all the way down to the physical world. That's our first incarnation, learning how to live in the world. We've got our new dog now, our beautiful Callisto, Razzle's daughter. And she has lived her whole life in a cage or at shows. Now, it was a great big cage with a dog. She's been perfectly happy. She's a beautifully balanced girl. But she's just spent the last 2 days in a home with a garden, with a sofa, with a kitchen, with cooking, with walks. And she is like an absolute baby. That's the first incarnation. She's going crazy. She's stealing things off the table. She's chewing things. She's running around in circles. She's jumping up. She's filled with delight. She's chasing blackbirds. She's chased the chickens. She's trying to chase sheep. She's chased a cow. She's all over the place. She's just explosive enthusiasm for this new life. That's the first incarnation, when we come down and we break everything. The second series of incarnations, the second journey, is learning. Learning how to live on this planet, learning how to live in this household, learning how to live with us, getting used to it. The third journey is teaching that to others. Our other beagle, Desi, is on the third journey at the moment because she's teaching Callisto. Callisto is starting already to look to her to know what to do, because Desi's getting it right, not breaking things and not hurting herself, which Callisto currently is a little bit. So the second and third journeys are generally done together. You learn a bit, teach a bit, learn a bit, teach a bit. And then the fourth journey is the return, the divine return up to the divine. So we here on this webinar are on the second and third journeys simultaneously. And Jacob's Ladder represents the bringing down of the sky god to meld with the earth goddess, if you like. So it's bringing back masculine and feminine. It's representing the idea that humanity is the linking two between the sky god and the earth goddess, the masculine and the feminine. And it gives us the knowledge that we are the divine and we simultaneously seek the divine. And number 23, I'm not going to go through that one because we're way over time already. But it shows that the temple, the design of the temple in the Book of Exodus, fits Jacob's Ladder perfectly. Go into that in your own time if you want to. Interestingly, the stories of the women in the Hebrew Testament fit the tree and the ladder much better than the stories of the ten of the men. And these stories are all pre-Second Temple. So they are all stories of the balance between divinity and humanity. So the divine dichotomy, which I've banged on about through the whole of this webinar is we are divine and we seek the divine. And from the movie and the book Cloud Atlas, one of the closing quotations is, no matter what you do, it will never amount to anything more than a single drop in a limitless ocean. That's said to the father-in-law of the man who intends to give the rest of his life and his lives in future lives towards the abolition of slavery, having learnt through experience that slaves are true human beings. That's what his father-in-law says to him. Nothing you will do will account for anything. It will just be a drop in a limitless ocean. And the answer he gives is the pure answer of the follower of Christ. But what is an ocean but a multitude of drops? And as Margaret Mead said, never think that one person acting will not change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that does. So to end, some thoughts. Jesus is not Mr. Christ. Christ is not Jesus' surname. It's a title. It's a title that we all have the potential to carry. Creation works in repeating patterns. Tree of Life and Japheth's Labyrinth are purely diagrams, the structure, the scaffolding of those patterns. It's very useful. It is not a religion. And no Kabbalist should ever tell you there is only one way of doing things. There isn't. It's a Kabbalistic structure which you can use. You can live without it. I found it very useful. I hope you do too. It's not a religion. We're both divine and we're human. We're both perfect and we're flawed. We are the only begotten of God. The Son of Man was Jesus. The man is the divine baby, Adam Kadmon, the world of absolute. We are all the sons of God. As soon as we are Christed, we also become the Son of Man, because we're actually at that place on Jacob's ladder. We are the only begotten of God because every one of us is one soul in the divine baby that's currently in the process of incarnation. We will all perfect eventually. Humanity is incredibly young. We're breaking things. And Christianity is about following Jesus' teachings, not about worshipping him. To worship Jesus is completely missing the point. To follow him is darned hard work. And finally, just to close, well, thank you for a start. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Don't believe a word I say. It's not about me. I am not your guru. I just happen to be somebody who loves this work and has passed on some of my knowledge to you as information. Your job is to take the information that you find useful, hone it with your experience, and turn it into your knowledge, which will be your wisdom, your truth, your journey, your faith. Thank you very much, and I hope you'll join me again on another webinar.